Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Hello, y'all, and welcome back to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast. I have another great guest for you, as always, focused on the volunteer state and our nation today, with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. This time, special guest James Amundson. But first, for more information about the Mill Creek View podcast, visit us on Spotify, iTunes, or anywhere you get your podcast at Mill Creek View, Tennessee. And don't forget to subscribe to the show so you won't miss a single episode. And thank you for listening. Welcome to our People in the News episode, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are talking with James Amundson. Through broad-based grassroots outreach, Americans for Prosperity is driving long-term solutions to the country's biggest problems. AFP activists engage friends and neighbors on key issues and encourage them to take an active role in building a culture of mutual benefit, where people succeed by helping one another. We recruit and unite concerned citizens in 35 states to advance policies that will help people improve their lives. Deputy State Director for Tennessee, James Amundson, and now designated aide and future district director for Congressman-elect Andy Ogles. Congratulations, my friend. We're talking to you live from the swamp in D.C. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing quite well. And for those folks who can actually watch this via, I'm not sure if you're going to go on which media sources, but for those that can see, there's an actual image of the Capitol right behind me. But yes, I'm right here in Washington, D.C., a little far from home. But thank you so much for giving me the opportunity, Steve, to be on your show. Thank you for sharing Americans for Prosperity's mission and vision. That's you know, important words by which we operate and you know, work by. So thank you for enlightening your listeners to the work we do.
Absolutely. And thanks for taking time out of your busy D.C. glad handing and whatnot back there. Hopefully we didn't take you away from too much, but we're glad to have you here. Why don't you give everybody a little background on yourself so that we know who we're talking with, and then we'll get into the depths of AFP and the rest.
Certainly. One of the things that we like to share whenever we're meeting with new people in new groups is kind of our story, our why so many of us are involved with Americans for Prosperity in this effort. And you know, my story actually begins with the story of my mother, who was born and raised in former Yugoslavia. She was one of two daughters in a Muslim family, and she worked diligently to get an education while she was back at home. It wasn't common for someone to get past the eighth grade if they were a young woman in Bosnia. So you know, she had to struggle a little bit just to graduate high school and then go on to university. But then when she had the opportunity to leave Yugoslavia, she absolutely did. She met my father in Germany, and that's where I was born. And, you know, that kind of also explains why I'm passionate about American politics. You know, I learned when I was in the fifth grade that despite the fact that I had received citizenship through my father in 1978. I was born several years earlier, but wasn't able to get citizenship until we came to the United States. But my fifth grade civics teacher quickly informed me that you know, I could never be president of the United States. That was actually, you know, a childhood dream. But since I wasn't a naturally born American citizen, I could never hold high office in this country. But that made me nonetheless passionate about American politics. You know, I grew up during the Reagan era and just had a fondness for conservative politics. My mother instilled in me a desire and passion to preserve the American way of life, because if it wasn't for America, we would have never you know, had the prosperity that my family enjoys today. We were able to bring over other members of our family to this country, especially during the wars in Yugoslavia, and they have likewise achieved the American dream. So that's definitely something I want to preserve for the future. It's something that inspires me every day. I know that my life could have been drastically different had my mother never made the decision to come to the United States with my father. So
well, that's a beautiful story, and we're certainly glad that you did. So why do you love Tennessee so much? And what has been your political involvement for the last 22 years in Tennessee? I think you started in 2000.
Yes, actually, I served in the United States Air Force. I was on active duty for 6 years, another 4.5 years as an active reservist. I felt like it was my duty to pay back to this country a small part of what it had given me. So I did serve in the military. And when I left the Air Force, I wanted an opportunity to marry a couple of my passions. I had a background in electrical engineering, electronics, as well as in healthcare. So I was able to find a job with a German healthcare company, of all things, that had a contract with Vanderbilt University, and that brought me to Nashville. So I was able to pursue my my vocational passion. And then one of the things that I felt was a struggle for me while I was in the military was not having a voice in politics. You know, you have to be very apolitical when you're serving on active duty. So, most of my military service was during the Clinton years, and there were a lot of bad policies that were passed during that time. But, once I was free from the entanglements of the military, I wanted to get very much involved in politics, and not just, screaming at the television every time somebody did something silly in Washington. I had a fond understanding of how important it was to be involved in local politics. Everything down to, county and city level politics. And that's where I really cut my teeth in Tennessee politics, was right here at the county level, in Williamson County especially.
Yeah. So tell us about American for Prosperity and how and why you joined them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You mentioned Andy Ogles at the introduction. Back in 2013, Andy had started up a chapter of Americans for Prosperity here in Tennessee. And he did ask me to join him in his effort to start up that chapter back in the early days. But I wasn't exactly confident in the story behind AFP or what they were going to be able to accomplish. I knew Andy quite well. We had been friends since 2000, I think 2002. So I'd known him for a long time. We'd been involved in a number of political campaigns over the years. But, I wasn't prepared to leave my very comfortable career in as an engineer for an IT company to come do politics full time. That seemed like quite the stretch. But there was this moment in 2015 when my third grade son at the time, I guess he was about 9 years old, asked me to come to career day at school. And, I was a proud dad. I was very honored that a 9-year-old would ask me to come to school and talk to the kids about what I did for a living. So, of course, I asked him, hey, do you want me to talk to the kids about studying math and science so they can, learn about being an engineer and things like that? And his response was quite quick and to the point. It's like, no, Daddy, I want you to come to school and talk about the Air Force. Well, that was in 2015, and I had not served on active duty since 2000. So it was 15 years since I had served in the military, and that was before he was even born. So I had to disappoint him. I said, "Christopher, sweetie, I love you, but I don't think it would be right for me to come to your school and talk about the Air Force. But I'll gladly come talk about being an engineer." And he'd come to work. He'd seen what I did for a living, and his response was, "No, thank you. I did not get to talk to the kids in his third grade class." And that was a wake up moment. There was a disconnect. It was a gut check in the sense that what I was doing wasn't as important to my son as what I had done before he was even born. So it wasn't shortly thereafter that Andy had given me a call one more time and he said, "Hey, look, I'll create a position for you. It won't be what you make now, but you'll have the additional reward of being able to do something that you're passionate about." And, at that moment, he was absolutely right. It was much more meaningful to, pursue this as a career and have a much greater impact on Tennessee and American politics.
Oh, that's an amazing story. Thanks for sharing that. So tell us, what does a deputy state director role entail?
Well, my primary responsibilities include managing the operations of the organization here in Tennessee, as well as managing our staff. But also, I'm required to lobby up at the state capitol during our legislative sessions, which is anywhere between 4 and 5 months out of the year. And then I spend the rest of the year advocating for our policies with our activist community. I often meet people where they are, either in group meetings or on their doorsteps. We do a lot of door knocking and phone banking, and getting people engaged directly in issues that are happening today, whether they're at their local level, state level, federal level. We've had a pretty broad-based outreach to our grassroots communities, just making sure that they know what laws are being passed that might, directly impact them, and how they can get involved and make a difference.
So AFP's vision statement is, we believe every person has unique gifts that enable them to realize their American dream, like you did. This amazing potential of every individual to contribute to society is why we elevate the voices of grassroots activists in all 50 states who want to achieve policy reforms that open opportunities for all. What are some top achievements in Tennessee and maybe some national?
Certainly. When I look at the history of our chapter, there have definitely been three major accomplishments that I like to point to. One of them pretty much started before I came on board as a full-time staff member, but certainly something I was engaged in as a volunteer and activist for Americans for Prosperity, and that was stopping Obamacare expansion here in Tennessee, or Medicaid expansion. That was an important policy. A victory for our chapter. There was definitely some momentum to take those federal dollars. Several state lawmakers have tried to pass reforms through our state-based Medicaid system to take those federal dollars and expand our program beyond what it was intended to do. And we've seen how in so many other states that's created a liability to specific states, and it's definitely not been good for their economies. And one of the things that we wanted to do is make sure that we preserve Tennessee's economy. It's one of the lowest taxed states in the nation. We've are well known for the fact we don't have a state income tax. We definitely didn't want to do anything that would jeopardize our state fiscally, where we might ever consider that. We did pass a state constitutional amendment back in 2014 that basically banned a state income tax. So that's definitely something that we didn't want to see our state get into any kind of fiscal trouble.
Wasn't
The
there
Medicaid.
actually a repeal of an income tax? I think it was named after someone named Hall. Does that, were
Yeah,
you?
so there was the Hall income tax. After we had passed a constitutional amendment in the state that said that we wouldn't have a state income tax. There's still a little known income tax. It was primarily a tax on dividend and investment income, which disproportionately, gosh, that's hard to say, disproportionately affected our retiree community. It's called the Hall income tax. It was about a 6% tax at the time. That was something that several different organizations had tried to repeal over the years. We did have State Senator at the time, Mark Green, propose a 1%, one-time 1% decrease in the Hall income tax. And we thought that the legislature could do better than that. So we worked with Representative Mark Pote at the time, who's now a state senator, and Billy Spivey to pass an amendment on the House floor that would actually accomplish a full repeal in 5 years' time. And that repeal did get passed. There was a lot of chaos on the House floor. Andy Ogles was very much involved in initiating that whole process and working with our lawmakers to get that passed. And at the end of the day, here we are in 2022, and we no longer have the last vestige of a income tax in our state. So that was
Oh,
a huge
well,
accomplishment for our chapter as well.
thank you for
And
that very much.
yeah, and then one other area that I feel like Americans for Prosperity has made a major impact in the state of Tennessee has been around certificate of need reform. For your listeners who are not familiar with what that means, it's basically a certificate of need is a government permission slip for new healthcare facilities to open up in our state. And since I've had a pretty strong background in healthcare as well as IT, but you know, having been a medic myself and you know, working with a number of hospitals in the state, you know, I had firsthand knowledge of how impactful certificate of need can be on opening new facilities. You know, something as simple as getting a new you know, CT scanner in a hospital requires a permission slip. And since I specialize in medical imaging, you know, it was kind of frustrating, you know, to be working with a facility for a number of years. And at the end of the day, some bureaucrat decides that, no, you know, there's not a need for that service, even though you can show that there absolutely is. You could have somebody, some other provider make a simple objection and you don't get your quote unquote permission slip. So we've made major inroads in streamlining that process. We haven't completely eliminated certificates of need in the state of Tennessee, but we have made some very significant changes to those laws that makes it much easier for new facilities to open and more especially, you know, to get greater access to those who need it.
And so with 35 chapters and active in all 50 states, what's something that's been done nationally that AFP can take credit for?
Well, we were absolutely instrumental in the Trump tax reforms that happened during his administration. AFP was on the front lines working with his administration. You know, we've that was historic. There had not been, you know, those kinds of tax cuts in, you know, since the, you know, I guess about 35 years, since 1992. Don't quote me on that year. That was the last major tax reform. So, you know, that was pretty, pretty monumental. You know, we're quite proud of being able to get that passed in short order. That was, you know, not just one of AFP's accomplishments, but, you know, certainly an accomplishment during that administration. You know, we've been making strides in a number of areas, you know, at the federal level, you know, just primarily around regulatory reforms. You know, there's just a whole host of things that we do at the federal level. I'm not directly involved in a lot of the work that gets done at the federal level outside of the fact that we get our activists in the state of Tennessee to call our federal delegation on a number of issues and make sure that folks know that they have our support. And when they have to make some of those difficult votes up at, here in DC or even back home in Tennessee, that you know, they're Americans for Prosperity volunteers and activists will definitely support them in those decisions.
And what can we look forward to in the 2023 policy agenda? I think it's called for government transparency.
Yeah, here in the state of Tennessee, there's a number of areas where we would love to see greater government transparency, especially at the state level and within the state legislature. I don't know if you're aware of this, but you know, there's a lot of power that our state legislative leadership has in the form of being able to you know, decide which bills see the light of day. And you know, it's amazing with supermajorities in both chambers that so little conservative legislation gets passed in this state. Yeah, there's a number of things that, you know, our lawmakers do quite well. You know, they pass a very fiscally conservative budget every year. That's their one main responsibility. And I can understand when, you know, some bills, you know, really push the envelope. But, you know, there's a little known fact that in the state house, most of the committee votes are not recorded, meaning that each individual lawmaker does not have their individual vote recorded whenever they are considering a bill. And so often the decision whether or not a bill passes is based on what a committee chairman does or does not hear. And there's been plenty of instances where, you know, say that the majority of the committee members vote yes for a bill, but unfortunately the chairman heard no. You know, that could be to our benefit. Sometimes it's you know, not to our benefit, but you know, it's a rule that they have used to maintain control and power in our state house, especially. Now in the state Senate, every single vote in every single committee meeting is recorded, except for maybe some of the you know, just administrative type votes. But anything that is a substantive vote in the state Senate, every single lawmaker has their vote recorded, and we're just asking that in the state House they do the same. Now we understand that that does you know, take
And
some of the power and control.
is that a long-standing tradition? I know Jack Johnson runs the Senate and Sexton runs the Congress. Have these guys inherited this, or do I have it backwards? No, that's right. Has this been
You had
going
it
on a
right.
long time, or is this new?
No, this is not new. But you know, we know that when Democrats had control of the state house, that they did. There was a time when they did have every vote recorded. So it's not as if it's been a long time since that rule has been in place. But I'm sure you can see where it might be to someone's advantage. You know, maybe there's really a bad bill, and you know, it really does not need to get passed. It's so easy to kill it in committee rather than have lawmakers make a difficult vote on the floor. And you know, there's some value to that. And, you
And
know,
they
I
don't
can
post those
understand.
online, do they?
No, they don't. Well, all the votes are recorded in the sense of, you know, whether or not it
The
passed or
bills
failed.
themselves, yeah.
Well, the bills are online, but one of the other things we're asking for in the form of transparency is the bill amendments.
Oh, they meant.
So what happens also is there will be amendments that are proposed, and lawmakers don't even get to see those amendments until minutes before they have to vote. You know, there is a system, there is a means by which they can access those bill amendments, but often it's put into a huge PDF document. All of the bill amendments are lumped together. There's no rhyme or reason as to what order they're in. There's no way to search that document to, you know, find a specific bill number. So yes, the bill amendments are available, but it's not, you know, the bill amendments are not with the bill themselves. If you're a layperson, or even somebody like myself, I know the system. I know how to find a bill amendment, but you know, for the average person, if they want to find out, you know, what's going to change with someone's proposal, they have no way to see that in advance of the lawmakers casting their vote. So that's
And you
something
know,
that we would love to see them
one of the things
change.
I've noticed in a Republican state versus where I come from or where Steve is sitting in a very blue of the bluest states, you know, you have your candidates who will be pro-life and pro-gun. So that's kind of off the table. So, you know,
Sure.
but then you've got your corporatists. Which industries are the biggest problem? And I ask that in the context of there's not very good reporting for taxpayer-funded lobbying in Tennessee, right?
Well, no, there really isn't. It's you'd be amazed at how much taxpayer money gets spent on lobbyists who actually advocate against the taxpayer who's paying their salary.
Right, of course.
You know, of course, the executive administration has legislative liaisons for every one of their agencies, and you know, all of those folks are happy to give their opinion on a number of bills, but you know, we don't pay those folks to tell our lawmakers how to vote for legislation. And then similarly, there's a number of associations and organizations within state government that also have lobbyists that are, again, paid with taxpayer dollars, and we have no insight to what their contracts are, how much is being spent, and you know how they're using those dollars, and especially on what bills they're advocating.
And do you think there's a good chance of making that more transparent? Because obviously those steak and bourbon dinners are not free, but if taxpayers are paying for them and not getting what they want from their elected officials, we should know next time the ballots come to our door.
Well, you know, Americans for Prosperity, especially our chapter here in Tennessee, we have attempted on multiple occasions to get bills passed that would lend greater transparency. Unfortunately, you know, there's that committee process that you know, often stifles our efforts. I think it's going to require a lot more education of the public, make sure that they understand why this is important. And that's kind of our effort in 2023. We're absolutely going to make an effort to propose these reforms again. I think it's something that's going to take a little bit more time, but we have to start somewhere.
So for those that don't know, you are now working with a representative in a district that didn't exist before, right? This was the Starbuck, Ortegas, Ogles, Final Victor district. So now you have one more person on your list that you can ask for these assistance with this type of thing. So what attracted you to Congressman-elect Andy Ogles, besides that you've known him for 20 years? And what's your role and what are his priorities and your priorities?
Absolutely. Honestly, my relationship with Andy, like I mentioned earlier, goes back to the early 2000s. And what impressed me about Andy back then, little known fact, this is not Andy's first attempt at Congress. He actually ran for Congress in the old 4th Congressional District. There was a portion of the 4th Congressional District at that time in the early 2000s. That included southern part of Williamson County, where Andy lived, and it had been seat held by a longtime Democrat, Lincoln Davis. So Andy had the ambition back then to run for that House seat. He lost in the primary back then, but the fact that this young guy was, willing to put his neck on the line and even make this audacious attempt. There was just something about Andy back then. I knew he was going to be a strong leader. I knew he was going to do something great for our state. I didn't know it would take 20 years for him to get to this point. But every time Andy got involved in something political, he often called me up to see if it was something I'd be interested in. And it was one of those situations where it's like, well, If it's something that you think we should do, Andy, let's go do it.
He must think highly of you because you're the designated aide and he's not even sworn in yet until January 3rd. And there you are in DC with him. So that's you are his right-hand man, right?
I have for many years been exactly that, his right-hand man. In fact, that's kind of the way I described my role when I was first hired with Americans for Prosperity is, I'm Andy's deputy, I'm his right-hand man. He's just always been a strong conservative leader. Strong convictions, very principled person. Andy, tells you like it is, and what you see is what you get. So, he's someone that inspired me back then, and continues to inspire me to this day. I'm looking forward to what he'll be able to accomplish here in Washington D.C. There's a lot of things that we hope to get done in the next 2 years. I think the focus right now is just getting settled in, trying to get a better understanding, the lay of the land, so to speak. Washington, D.C. is very, very different than, Nashville, Tennessee. And
not so nice to the newcomers. But he is joining 221 other Republicans who supposedly will be of like mind. Where do you see him caucusing or committees, or what can we watch from Andy in the next 2 years?
Well, Andy's background is as an economist, so we're hoping that he can get a committee assignment, something that would lend to his strengths, whether it's in financial services or on judiciary. Those would be the ideal committees for his talents. So we're hoping that something will work out in that regard. There's a number of things that I know he would like to get accomplished, but it's probably not something that's going to happen in the first 6 months or a year. It might be second portion of the session that we'll be able to get some more substantive things considered. But again, we're up here basically doing a new member orientation, finding where the bathrooms are and where the coffee machine is, those kinds of silly things. It's drinking from a fire hose, or as one member described it, being sprayed by 100 fire hoses, because there's just a lot of information coming at us from multiple directions.
Yeah. And I'll have that $32 trillion of debt to work on. And I'm sure that the other members would say,
Yes.
oh, if you don't want to spend it in Tennessee, that's fine. We'll spend it over here.
You
So,
know, that's, you know, getting our economy back on track and, you know, trying to slow down inflation, those are definitely priorities for Andy.
good. So I'd like to talk some more local if you can.
Oh, absolutely.
Awesome. So local media. The left is pretty savage. Even in a red state, you wrote an op-ed in the Tennessean of all places. So tell us what your dealings with the press is like, and do you have an experience with them, and have your go-tos?
Well, thankfully, you know, I don't have to be in front of the camera too often. I usually let Tori Venable, our current state director, handle those types of interactions. You know, the media here in Tennessee isn't as bad as it used to be. We were definitely more demonized in the early days. I remember there was one political cartoon that was drawn when I first started with AFP. It was supposed to be, you know, an ogre pulling the puppet strings. This was, you know, kind of a suggestion that, you know, Americans for Prosperity was this out-of-state organization that was trying to control our state legislature, and nothing could have been farther from the truth. You know, Andy Ogles, who started the chapter here, you know, is a seventh generation Tennessean. His family goes back to the founding of the state. So, you know, any depiction of you know, our chapter as being you know, out of state, you know, money trying to pull strings, that was you know, that was the farthest thing from the truth. But you know, we've definitely come a long way, you know, with Tori Venables' communications background and her relationship with a number of media outlets. You know, we were able to kind of change that characterization over the years. They're a little bit more friendly to us. You know, they don't describe us in such negative terms anymore. And it's just, you know, it's one of the situations where you have to build relationships with, you know, all the reporters, even the Tennessean. And you know, it's basically playing the long game. You know, we know that if we want to get our message out, if we want to have some effect on the narrative, we're going to have to you know, make some friends. And that's what it's taken over the years.
Okay. You guys were active in Amendment One, which we just passed, all four of the constitutional amendments, state constitution amendment to protect Tennessee's status as a right to work state. If I could just read this real quick. As a right to work
Sure.
state, Tennessee has enjoyed higher employment rates, faster wage growth, and lower government dependency compared to union heavy states. By approving Amendment One, Tennessee voters have chosen to protect workers over union bosses. This should be a strong signal to Congress and activist judges who try to impose the will of Washington, D.C. on Tennessee. We are very strong here on states' rights versus federal rights and how the federal government, with a lot of strings attached, will send money in and make administrators, boards kind of jump to a tune that the voters don't really like at all, actually don't like at all. How do you feel about that amendment, and what has been your responsibilities for it, or not your responsibilities, but your involvement in it, and to get it passed?
Oh, absolutely. Americans for Prosperity was, you know, very involved in getting that piece of legislation through two different legislative bodies or general assemblies here in the state of Tennessee. It was first proposed by Brian Kelsey. Gosh, I'm trying to remember which year that was, but it was in the previous general assembly. Again, passed in the current General Assembly and went on to the ballot this year. You know, we've absolutely key voted that piece of legislation, which is basically, you know, letting all the lawmakers know that this was a an important piece of legislation for our organization, and that we would definitely appreciate their support, and we would use it on our scorecard. And, you know, that hopefully had an impact on some of their decision making. But more importantly, once that amendment was put on the ballot, you know, we were involved in you know, promoting it through the media, as well as through our own grassroots capability, you know, forming our activists of the benefits of right to work. So, you know, it's definitely something that was important to our organization. It's important to me. You know, I think it's kind of ironic. The hotel I'm sitting at right now is right across the street from the Teamsters Union. In my research, I discovered that my grandfather was actually a Teamster for his union up in Wisconsin. So, you know, I have a little bit of credibility. I do understand, the importance of unions. And, you know, our right to work laws are not meant to, punish unions. In fact, they do quite the opposite. What it simply does is it protects our workers from both employers and unions. There's no penalty whether or not someone decides to be in a union or not to be in a union. And that's really the way it should be. Each individual should be able to make that decision without feeling pressure from one side or the other. It's definitely a free market principle, and it's that's the basis on which America's prosperity makes a lot of its decisions. You know, is this something that just is a good free market policy? And it has been. It's been passed in 26 states or 27 states as far as legislation is concerned, and we are the 14th state to have a constitutional amendment that secures it.
That's great. And you had called on state and local leaders to scrutinize Oracle, right, amid reports of layoffs
Yes.
after the company received nearly $250 million in taxpayer money.
Yes.
Oracle has received $65 million in economic community development grants from the state to create 5,000 new jobs and $175 million in local property tax breaks. You guys said, we're calling on the legislature to utilize clawbacks on ECD funding if employment numbers are not hitting benchmarks, and on Metro Council to examine foregone revenue from future property tax breaks. And I think this is a quote from you. If true, layoffs by Oracle are a massive breach of taxpayer trust. It is exactly why clawback provisions are important with any deal the government makes. If a company is not living up to their community development promises, taxpayers should not be stuck with the bill to fund a private business. Businesses' profits. So we have Ford moving in, we have LG now, and the NFL, of course. Tennessee has a big corporatist culture, let's just say. I asked earlier, and I think we missed it, but what industries are the biggest problems?
Well, it's actually not just companies like Oracle, but other manufacturing companies. You did mention Ford. You mentioned LG. You described it as a corporatist culture. We actually describe it as a problem with corporate welfare. And I know we've gotten a little sideways with some lawmakers when we describe it as such. They consider a lot of these economic and community development grants to be investments. We don't think it's the role of government to make investments on behalf of taxpayer or to put our money at risk. We actually describe that as being corporate, as providing corporate welfare, picking winners and losers. And that's just not the role of government. And Tennessee has definitely developed a strong reputation for supporting corporate welfare. It's not something that is just a problem with the current Republican leadership, but was certainly the case when Democrats ran the state. We're just asking for there to be greater accountability when some of these companies don't live up to the promises that they make, because those aren't just promises that they're making to lawmakers. Those are promises that they're making to us as taxpayers. If they say they're going to create 5,000 jobs, create those jobs, make sure that those are new jobs. Those aren't just jobs that they're importing from out of state and bringing more people to the state, which is great. We love that kind of growth, but we also want to see Tennesseans benefit from these particular deals. There's very little
Sometimes those can be
transparency on
very
these deals.
woke corporations or
Yes.
unionized corporations that would change an entire community, which would ch change an electorate, which could get it back to be a Democratic state one day, and then we might not be so happy.
Yeah,
On that note, oh, go
I
ahead.
was going to say, all we have to do is look south to Georgia. What was very much a strong red
Exactly.
state is very much a purple and going quickly blue.
And that's exactly what I wanted to ask you next. I mean, we have Wyoming, Montana, Utah, Tennessee, maybe Oklahoma, for sure Florida, sometimes Texas. How would you rate Tennessee in conservative constitutional adherence from the legislatures?
Oh, wow. You're going to put me on the spot with making that kind of assessment. Wow.
I think you're on record already, but yes, I wanted to get.
Yeah, despite the fact that we do have these Republican supermajorities, it's very much an indictment that very little, I'm just repeating myself from earlier, very little a true conservative legislation gets passed. So, I would honestly rank Tennessee as, a B minus or C plus, if I was going to give it a letter grade when it comes to, passing some truly constitutionally conservative legislation. Protecting our rights, protecting our freedoms, especially. We saw what happened during the pandemic. It wasn't as if Tennessee was really standing out in terms of making sure that we were protecting individual rights. Tennessee went out of its way to protect corporate rights, to protect the government. They're even considering some legislation that again would preserve. The government or prevent the government from being accountable for some of these COVID vaccine mandates, which isn't an AFP issue, but is certainly a freedom and a liberty issue.
Exactly right. That's well said. And the perception outside of the state, obviously, is that it is the reddest of the red states, but maybe internally it could use a little work. How would you compare, say, Lee to DeSantis, who seems to be the leader of the Republican movement, when I would really like to see Lee, who represents the reddest of red states, be the leader of that movement?
Ooh, now we're treading in some territory where
Well, you're now working for a federal elected official, no longer state, so you're free to say what you'd like.
to be fully transparent, I did work for Governor Lee after he was first inaugurated. I was the chief of staff for the Tennessee Department of Veteran Services. What I did witness from within his administration was that there was this huge carryover. Of bureaucracy and a lot of appointments that came from the previous Haslam administration. There's that fourth branch of government that is very persistent and pervasive in Tennessee government. That permanent bureaucracy. I would have liked to have seen a lot more folks weeded out through that process. Governor Lee is doing a fine job, don't get me wrong. Trying to compare Governor Lee and Governor DeSantis, I don't know that I'm qualified to make that kind of a judgment. I
Well, how
haven't
about
worked
this? How
for
about
Governor
the
DeSantis, so.
that's well said. In the last 3 minutes we have with you here, the Tennessee legislature, how about that? So versus, say, Virginia or Youngkin and the school boards, in Florida, they just kicked out six of the nine with DeSantis endorsements of liberal school boards, and they just this week voted to fire their poor pro-mask superintendents in those. So that's dramatic.
That
Do
is. That's...
you see anything like that here?
No, there's definitely not been any effort in like that here in the state of Tennessee. We still have elected school boards, but those school boards are also responsible for selecting their superintendents. I wouldn't be opposed to seeing our state go back to having elected superintendents, school superintendents, that is, so that those folks could be held accountable. To the public. We saw what happened to
2 minutes.
school boards in Virginia, but we had the same problem here in Tennessee. We would definitely like to have parents be recognized at school board meetings and not demonized in the media, especially not investigated by the FBI and called terrorists.
I think they just changed that rule too. And Williamson County has 24 commissioners that have pretty much no power over schools. Penny Schwinn does, appointed by Lee from California. Listening to, I believe, the Department of Education. So we do have some issues here at home. Last thing I want to ask you, would you be in favor of a property tax cap since we don't have an income tax here?
Oh, that's a slippery slope. Property taxes are the primary source of revenue for our county governments, and a property tax cap. That we would have to look at how that would be structured. I definitely would like to see greater transparency in how they let the public know about property tax increases. There's We could have a long discussion on how property taxes are decided in every county.
That's
And
true. And I do hope to have you back, so we'll save it for later.
oh,
But
good.
just so you know, Wyoming just had a
That's actually one of the
34.
things that got, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say Wyoming has a 34% hike coming to them, so that without a cap, there is that danger. But we are at the end of our time here. I definitely want to have you back. You are a
Thank
wealth of
you. Appreciate
knowledge. I
that.
really appreciate it. So please tell our listeners where they can go to find out more about you and Andy and Americans for Prosperity.
Oh, absolutely. For Andy Ogles, that's really easy right now. AndyOgles.com. That's the best way to learn about what he was able to accomplish during the campaign. But for Americans for Prosperity, our website is Americans for Prosperity, all spelled out, .org, O-R-G. So those are the best online resources. We have our state chapters headquartered right here in, well, I say here, I'm obviously in D.C., but back home in south of Nashville. If folks want to come visit us, they can certainly come reach out to us via email and online, and we'll certainly get in touch with folks.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for coming on with us and enjoy your time in the swamp.
Thank you, Steve. You have a great day.
See you soon. Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show, where we cover what we just heard and anything else on my mind today. Steve, what'd you think of Americans for Prosperity and James?
Well, James is a well-spoken individual. He knows his stuff. He's been around for quite a while, so it's very interesting that he transitions now. He's going to be working for, is it a state rep? Is he he's going to be working for now?
No, he's in D.C. He's going to be working for our U.S. Congressman, Andy Ogles.
Okay, so he's your brand new voted, newly minted congressman.
Congressman, yep, and hopefully he'll be on the show very soon.
Oh, very cool. I like it.
Yeah, that was it made national news, you know, two Trump friends, I guess, Morgan Ortegas and Starbuck. I always forget his first name. His wife's name is Landon, Robbie Starbuck.
Right.
They tried to run for that seat, that newly carved out fifth district, and were not allowed to. And they changed the rules. It said you can't run for 3 years unless you've lived here that long. So I can't run. And not that I want it. And Andy did. And Andy won. And that was good. He was not the establishment candidate. And so James and Andy, I think, will do great work in D.C. So I put together a little bit of history lesson for us all, and I wanted to share it. Clip number one, I think you'll like this, Steve. It's called The Secret Methods the CIA Used to Spread Propaganda, according to a 1983 expose by a former agent. Please run that.
Another thing is to disseminate propaganda to influence people's minds. And this is a major function of the CIA. And unfortunately, of course, it overlaps into the gathering of information. You have contact with a journalist, you will give him true stories, you'll get information from him, you'll also give him false stories.
Did you do buy his confidence with true stories?
You buy his confidence and set him up. We've seen this happen recently with Jack Anderson, for example, who has his intelligence sources, and he has also admitted that he's been set up by them. You know, every fifth story just simply being false. You also work on their human vulnerabilities to recruit them in a classic sense, to make them your agent so that you can control what they do, so you don't have to set them up sort of, you know, by putting one over on them. So you can say, here, plant this one next Tuesday.
Can you do this with responsible reporters?
Yes, the Church Committee brought it out in 1975, and then Woodward and Bernstein put an article in Rolling Stone a couple of years later. 400 journalists cooperating with the CIA, including some of the biggest names in the business, to consciously introduce the stories into the press.
You're nodding your head, Steve. I guess you've heard that before.
Yeah, and if you've read, since you read my book, I do include some of this kind of content in my book of how the military and or the CIA actually do this. And I kind of show you their documentation of how they do this. And yeah, their 80s, it was kind of interesting, Steve. In the 1980s, a lot of this type of stuff was coming out. They also found out the CIA was running drugs. The cocaine was all coming in from the CIA during the 80s. And all of a sudden when the 90s hit, it was like all that got shut down. And especially after 9/11, it's like we don't hear any of this stuff anymore.
Well, you're about to. So 1 year after that clip, that was 1983, in 1984, we had a defector, Yuri Brezhmanov. He warned America what was happening. Play that one.
Please. Was born in 1939 in a suburb of Moscow. He was the son of a high-ranking Soviet Army officer. He was educated in the elite schools inside the Soviet Union and became an expert in Indian culture and Indian languages. He had an outstanding career with Novosti, which was the, and still is, I should say, the press arm or the press agency of the Soviet Union. It turns out that this is also a front for the KGB. He escaped to the West in 1970 after becoming totally disgusted with the Soviet system, and he did this at great risk to his life. He certainly is one of the world's outstanding experts on the subject of Soviet propaganda and disinformation and active measures. Well, you spoke several times before about ideological subversion. That is a phrase that I'm afraid some Americans don't fully understand. When the Soviets use the phrase ideological subversion, what do they mean by it?
Ideological subversion is the slow process which we call either ideological subversion or active measures, активные мероприятия in the language of the KGB, or psychological warfare. What it basically means is to change the perception of reality of every American to such an extent that despite of the abundance of information, no one is able to come to sensible conclusions in the interests of defending themselves, their families, their community, and their country. It's a great brainwashing process which goes very slow, and it's divided in four basic stages. The first one being demoralization. It takes from 15 to 20 years to demoralize a nation. Why that many years? Because this is the minimum number of years which requires to educate one generation of students in the country of your enemy, exposed to the ideology of the enemy. In other words, Marxism-Leninism ideology is being pumped into the soft heads of at least three generations of American students without being challenged or counterbalanced by the basic values of Americanism, American patriotism. The demoralization process in the United States is basically completed already. For the last 25 years, actually it's over-fulfilled because demoralization now reaches such areas where previously not even Comrade Andropov and all his experts would even dream of such a tremendous success. Most of it is done by Americans to Americans, thanks to lack of moral standards. As I mentioned before, exposure to true information does not matter anymore. A person who was demoralized is unable to assess true information. The facts tell nothing to him. Even if I shower him with information, with authentic proof, with documents, with pictures, even if I take him by force to the Soviet Union and show him concentration camp, he will refuse to believe it. Until he is going to receive a kick in the in his fat bottom.
Wake up.
When a military boot crashes his balls, then he will understand, but not before that. That's the tragic of the situation of demoralization. The next stage is destabilization. This time, subverter does not care about your ideas and the patterns of your consumption. Whether you eat junk food and get fat and flabby, doesn't matter anymore. This time, and it takes only from 2 to 5 years to destabilize a nation. It's what matters is essentials: economy, foreign relations, defense systems. And you can see it quite clearly that in some areas, in such sensitive areas as defense and economy, the influence of Marxist-Leninist ideas in the United States is absolutely fantastic. I could never believe it 14 years ago when I landed in this part of the world that the process will go that fast. The next stage, of course, is crisis. It may take only up to 6 weeks to bring a country to the verge of crisis. You can see it in Central America now. And after crisis, with a violent change of power, structure, and economy, you have so-called the period of normalization. It may last indefinitely. Normalization is a cynical expression borrowed from Soviet propaganda. When the Soviet tanks moved into Czechoslovakia in 68, Comrade Brezhnev said, "Now the situation in brotherly Czechoslovakia is normalized." This is what will happen in the United States if you allow all these schmucks to bring the country to crisis, to promise people all kind of goodies and the paradise on earth, to destabilize your economy, to eliminate the principle of free market competition, and to put a big brother government in Washington, D.C., with the benevolent dictators like Walter Mondale, who will promise lots of things, never mind whether the promises are fulfillable or not. Your leftists in the United States, all these professors and all these beautiful civil rights defenders, they are instrumental in the process of the subversion only to destabilize the nation. When their job is completed, they are not needed anymore. They know too much. Some of them, when they get disillusioned, when they see that Marxist-Lenin has come to power, obviously they get offended. They think that they will come to power. That will never happen, of course. They will be lined up against the wall and shot. But they may turn into the most bitter enemies of Marxist-Leninists when they come to power. And that's what happened in Nicaragua. You remember most of these former Marxist-Leninists were either put to prison or one of them split, and now he's working against Sandinistas. It happened in Grenada when Maurice Bishop was already a Marxist. He was executed by a new Marxist who was more Marxist than this Marxist. Same happened in Afghanistan when first there was Taraki, he was killed by Amin, then Amin was killed by Babrak Karmal with the help of KGB. Same happened in Bangladesh when Mujibur Rahman, very pro-Soviet leftist, was assassinated by his own Marxist-Leninist military comrades.
I think we get the point. That was 38 years ago, right? And does it ring a bell on anything that's happening right now?
Steve, 9/11 was the shot across the bow. You have to do some research on that. It's not anything that the mainstream or the government tells you it was. It basically turned every country in the world into a security country, because prior to 2001, you could get on a plane. You could go anywhere you wanted. You could take a suitcase full of cash. No one cared. You could get away. You could do a lot of things. And the bottom line, 9/11 changed everything with the Patriot Act. Every airport became a security. Only place that was like that was Israel. And so consequently, when that crisis happened, now here we are 20 years later, COVID happened. And look at all the same kind of things that went in place, the normalizations. Yep. Steve, it's just a repeat, wash, repeat, wash, repeat.
And I know my listeners are not, as he said, the soft heads, but not everybody has this front and center to press play on all the time. And so I thought it was really important to hear from the former agent and the former defector of Russia. Yep. In context, because, you know, we're in media, right? We're talking to people. We're trying to find people who are making a positive impact in our community and tell the truth. And so they're surrounded by, James said, 1,000 fire hoses all at once of disinformation. And so I want to play clip number 3 in that context. I know that last clip was very long, and I'm sorry for that, but it is very important. It actually goes on much longer, about 6 minutes. You should all look it up. But let's hear what, fast forwarding to today, 2022, passes for information.
Play but clip, I have to go back, and I hate to harp on it. This is a party whose main, forget Donald Trump for a moment. Their mainstream politicians are banning books about the Holocaust.
Oh?
Their mainstream supposedly politicians are banning books by Black and LGBTQ authors. Their mainstream politicians are suing Disney because they don't like the fact that Disney makes, you know, films with too many gay people in them and they don't like it. They don't say gay is the policy in a mainstream Republican's state that he runs. They're banning protest. This is my challenge, Claire, is that this kid is an idiot who does a, you know, he's an idiot Nazi who does a show in his parents' basement. But the problem is the supposedly better Republicans are doing the stuff I just mentioned, and they get called mainstream just because their name isn't Trump.
So the title of that was MSNBC's Joy Reid Lashes Out at GOP Lies About Holocaust Book Bans. Have you heard of or voted for anybody recently that wants to ban Holocaust books or say don't say gay?
Steve, I think are we broadcasting from our basements of our parents' house?
I am.
Yeah. The fact is, everything they say is a lie. A lie. It's propaganda. It's designed to stir up people's hearts, get them angry, and it's based on fabrications because there's nobody I know in the right side or left side, or I should say the right side, who's banning anything, Steve. Nothing.
No, but she's trying to create a crisis, just like Yuri Bezmarov said. This is part of that scam, and I'm hoping it fails dramatically, and in America we laugh at it and say, nice try, but we're on to your games. But, you know, she's still on the air. People are listening to her. She's a very, very racist human being, very evil person. Her name, Joy, is not a good description of her. Maybe Joyless. Okay, I think I've made the point, but I do want to run clip number four. This one called Desperate Media's Final Scare Tactic. GOP Will Destroy Democracy.
We are watching Republicans not just destroying democracy in the dark, breaking into election officers and plugging stuff in. We're watching them do it from rally stages, debate stages.
We could lose our democracy, and it could happen in 17 days.
A majority of Americans believe that democracy is under threat.
Democracy on the ballot, it's not just a slogan.
A lot of Republicans in the last 3 weeks have suddenly found themselves deciding, hey, party over country.
I'm wondering whether this puts America into the fast lane towards illiberal democracy.
I'm not going to say that, you know, the GOP are Nazis at this point or whatever, but it certainly sounds very familiar.
We will wake up the morning after Election Day. We might not even call it that anymore in 2 years.
The future is not Republican Party, so they have to cheat.
Do you think it's time to ask for friends and allies to come over and help us monitor our elections?
Do you think it requires, you know, a democracy commission?
The Republicans have an explicit incentive to make the economy worse.
They will cut Social Security. They're going to cut lunches for children.
If Republicans win control of one or both houses of Congress, they will do everything in their power to sabotage the economy.
Am I right? Am I right or am I wrong? I mean, that supercut has all the voices you would expect. I heard Joy Behar. I heard Nicole Insufferable Wallace. It goes on, and they just... And by the way, are we a democracy?
No, we're a republic.
They use that word all the time. Our democracy is at stake. Yeah, the mob rule that they like is at stake because if you go back to a constitutional republic, the document says it all, not the majority of the voters who would probably vote to say, empty the treasury and put it in my pocket. That's what the founders didn't want. That's what we got. Stay tuned for my thought of the week. Welcome to our Thought of the Week. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to the Mill Creek View podcast. Just go to iTunes, Spotify, Rumble, or anywhere really, and hit the subscribe button or follow button. And thanks for doing it. I was minding my own when I caught your eye. You floated over, asked for a light. Your gaze in the smoke haze said you'd enjoy making a game. I said, I'll give you a lighter if you tell me your name. Had your eyes on the stars, your feet on the ground. Seemed to look right through me as you sat down, right beside, put the smoke to your lips, your eyes had mine. Said, what's your name, little girl? How'd you make your way into my world? It seems in my heed you haven't flame. I'll light your lighter when you tell me your name. Whoopah. Country music singer, songwriter Jake Flint. Another died suddenly for the Google searches at 37 years old. Found dead last week, just hours after his wedding. He was an ambassador for Oklahoma Red Dirt Music. Flint released four studio albums in his career, beginning with his 2016 record, I'm Not Okay. He also was named Breakout Artist of the Year at the We Are Tulsa Music Awards in 2018. Well, that's it for this episode. Hope you liked it. Thank you, James Amundson. Until next time, this is your host, Steve Abramowitz, Editor-in-Chief, MillCreekViewOnline.com. Available today. Peace in our time.
Just minding my own, caught your eye. You floated over, asked me for a light. You gazed in the smoke, hey, you said you'd enjoy a good game. I said I'll give you a lighter if you tell me your name. You had your eyes on the stars, your feet on the ground. And the doors to your heart were the faintest brown. You seemed to look right through me as you sat down right beside. You put a smoke to your lips, your eyes met mine. Said, what's your name, little girl? How'd you make your way into my world? Seems in my heat.